1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Welcome to another edition of Feltus and Kale. Great to have you along with us. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and our local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And our first guest on the program today is Ed Sturley. And Ed is the Senior Director for State and National Campaigns at Save the Children Action Network. Ed is responsible for managing campaigns in targeted states, advocating for kids as well. And prior to joining SCAN, Ed spent 5 years at the National Parks Conservation Association, where he led the National Park Service Centennial Find Your Voice campaign and efforts supporting policies that connect kids with the outdoors. And it's a delight to have you with us, Ed. Welcome to Feltus and Kale.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning, and thanks for having me on during this important time.
Our pleasure.
Well, Ed, you are involved at Save the Children Action Network in so many issues, especially right now, both nationally and statewide, affecting children and families. One of those issues that's a hot topic recently is the $300 unemployment bump. Some states are getting out of that, including New Hampshire. Governor Chris Sununu said that at some point he will reject that federal money coming in to help those who are unemployed. Can you tell us a little bit about the arguments on each side and what your perspective is and the impact on children in this debate?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I mean, I think what's unfortunate here is that, you know, what we've seen over the last several months to a year now, you know, as we've been in the midst of the pandemic, it's just the really tremendous impact it's had on young children, you know, whether it's been disruption of early learning or really, you know, a pretty substantial growth in the amount of child hunger, which is really concerning. And then also, you know, Americans out of work and, you know, and a big component of, you know, Americans getting back to work, whether it's in New Hampshire or anywhere else in the country, is, you know, essentially having the resources they need, whether it be childcare or financial or food, to be able to provide to those families and get back to work. So, you know, now that, you know, here we are headed into the summer, which is already a really difficult time, no matter in a year where there isn't a global pandemic to find childcare, we're seeing shortages. You know, we're seeing, even if folks are eligible for childcare assistance or maybe had reliable childcare in the past, you know, this summer it might not be available, just given the incredible demand there is. Either people are trying to return to work or schools let out. Or just a lot of the restrictions, whether they be, you know, COVID-related closures or restrictions that have been in the childcare industry, you know, to keep kids safe. So, you know, I think, you know, what we at Save the Children Action Network, you know, from the beginning have been advocating for is, you know, financial relief and assistance, both for the childcare industry and for families. And that's come at the federal level. You know, Congress has really stepped up. The Biden administration particularly has stepped up in the last several months by passing the American Rescue Plan. You know, previous, like the CARES Act or legislation as well, that has done such a good job of providing the necessary funding that the childcare industry needs. But then it's really up to state and local governments to implement those dollars. And that's where we've seen a lot of inequity in how that's being approached. It's either, you know, states have been slow to start to implement some of these dollars, or, you know, they're trying to find ways to make sure that they're getting in a way that's used impactfully to keep childcare open or to help, you know, to help families the most. And, you know, and I think news like this over the last week, you know, as we're seeing governors make decisions, you know, it's a little concerning because, you know, you never want to see lawmakers, you know, look for ways to take away financial resources and support for families and kids, you know, rather than looking for ways to support them further, you know, as we're all trying to get back on our feet in the midst of this pandemic. So that, you know, that is really concerning. You know, I think we've seen in some states, you know, governors working in bipartisan fashion really to take a really proactive stance to try and give families additional financial security, whether it be through child care assistance grants or back to work grants or, you know, looking to kind of boost the child care, knowing that is what is, you know, the barrier for many parents to return to work. And what we don't want to see is that heading in the other direction.
Right. And one of the arguments you see, Ed, out there is that the unemployment insurance benefits are preventing people from getting back to work. And Ed, having been a legal aid lawyer representing people who are unemployed, seeking job training and assistance and unemployment insurance, I can tell you the law is if you reject an offer of suitable work, you're kicked off of unemployment, period. That's the law. That's the way it works. So this notion that people are out there rejecting job offers and taking unemployment, it's just not the way it works, and it's not the law. But that is the rhetoric out there. And Ed, what do you see as the barriers to getting people back to work, especially now in COVID?
I mean, I think we even saw at the federal level last week, you know, when the jobs reports came out, you know, the White House and the Treasury and the Fed and, you know, state lawmakers, they all immediately pointed to one of the major factors contributing to, you know, folks not being able to get back to work is the lack of childcare. And it goes without saying, I mean, the pandemic job response we've seen hasn't hit everyone the same. It's been particularly difficult. There's been incredible gender inequity in that women, particularly mothers, have taken the brunt of job losses. And there's also a big racial disparity, too. I mean, this has disproportionately impacted people of color, particularly in the Southeast right now, where, you know, I was reading up to half of the recipients of jobless benefits right now are Black Americans. I mean, so you know, this is a real concern, and some of the barriers are lack of childcare. If, you know, of course, there probably are lack of jobs in many places. But, you know, and we're hearing it from employers, too. I mean, you know, I read article after article of companies saying that one of the things they're prioritizing right now is making sure that childcare access is available so that they can provide, you know, those types of benefits for their employees and are looking for that, you know, when they're locating their businesses. You know, another piece has been, you know, I know the Census Bureau has really good data now, and it's kind of crazy because I think even, you know, when we had the Great Depression so many years ago and even the Great Recession, we didn't have as much data as we have now where, you know, they would pass, you know, bills and potential policy solutions and you had no idea what the impacts were until afterwards. Now you can kind of get that almost in real time. There's weekly household pulse surveys where you can go in there and you can read exactly what the barriers are for people to get back to work or what benefits they need. And food and nutrition benefit has been a big one. You know, I think, there was a study last week based off that data that showed that, you know, federal unemployment insurance led to a 35% relative decline in food insecurity, you know, helping end child hunger right now, which has grown in the United States. And that, you know, up to 3/4 of those who were even eligible for those benefits said that their kids didn't even have enough time or didn't sometimes have enough food to eat, even though they were eligible for programs like SNAP or WIC. So, I mean, it goes to show, you know, we have holes in our safety net, and you know, what we want to do right now is ensure that, you know, we're investing in childcare, that we're investing in programs that are going to make sure kids have enough to eat and not looking to take away benefits from families, particularly those who are, you know, on the ropes right now trying to get back to work.
Our guest on Feldes and Kahle today is Ed Sterley. Ed is the Senior Director for state and national campaigns at Save the Children Action Network. We'll take a quick break and be back with more. And Ed will continue to be with us here on Feldes and Kahle. We're presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9, 1450, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldes and Kahle, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and our local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Our guest on the show is Ed Sterley, and Ed is the Senior Director for State and National Campaigns at the Save the Children Action Network. Ed, how could states be doing a better job right now with distributing the money they have gotten from the federal government to get our child care centers back to more of a sense of normalcy?
You know, there's an incredible opportunity that states have right now at this moment because, you know, I feel like the phrase you've heard a lot in government over the last year or so has been build back better. And, you know, it sounds a little cliche now, but there actually is an opportunity to build back better when it comes to early childhood education, especially in states like New Hampshire, where there's such great opportunity, you know, in front and such a need. I mean, you know, it is a hard place in New Hampshire to be a working parent because there is such a critical lack of childcare that's needed for folks to work and for kids to be safe. You know, right now, as a part of the American Rescue Plan, you know, New Hampshire received, you know, upwards of $77 million in child care relief assistance. And, you know, advocates and state and lawmakers, you know, need to come together to talk about a plan in which they can invest in child care, invest in preschool, invest in early learning to ensure that kids, you know, are well on their way to success when they reach kindergarten. You know, I think that, you know, there have been states right now that I think are leading the way and looking at this as not only an investment in returning child care to the way it was, but an opportunity to kind of reimagine, you know, how we view care. Because, you know, I think it's kind of changed its value. I mean, I'll say I have a 5-year-old and twin toddlers. I'm never going to forget how difficult it was to work at home with them and teach them and feed them and care for them, you know, at home for a year. And I'm sure there are many families across the state who feel the same way and are now maybe seeing the value that child care plays in their lives, whether it's school or child care, a little differently. So, you know, I'm hoping, you know, you can look to neighbors in New Hampshire, can look to neighbors in Vermont and Massachusetts right now who just this past session are currently, you know, passing legislation to look to see how can we invest in universal pre-K, how can we invest in universal child care, and viewing this moment as an opportunity to make, even though we can't afford those things right now, we have to work towards those, you know, to make a down payment and to come together and say, how can we achieve those things? Because that's what's going to make a big difference, I think, you know, to viewing child care as, you know, a necessity, almost like a public good, just like we do K-12 education, and making investments in that to treat it that way as well.
Well, Ed, as a parent of two young daughters, Iris and Josie, Iris coming up in 4 years old, Josie is 2.5. Our child care center, Aaron and I's child care center, was shut down for a good chunk of the, you know, 3 or 4 months of the early part. And obviously, another thing that happens too that impacts working parents is the COVID protocols. You know, if there's a kid with a runny nose or if there's something going on, you know, oftentimes strictly enforced, you take your kid out, but you still have to pay. So you still pay for that fixed cost of childcare. So what are some of the policy recommendations, specific policy recommendations? You talked, Ed, about planning for the long term, universal childcare, universal pre-K. But what are some of the specific things, policy recommendations that you would make for different states out there, including New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are really pretty basic steps that any state can take to kind of, you know, start tiptoeing towards expanding investments in childcare. You know, whether it be through compensating childcare providers based off enrollment rather than attendance right now. You know, that's been a big issue, particularly related to, as you pointed out, you know, having limited restrictions based on the number of kids you can have in a class. But then also, you know, the childcare industry is based on really kind of razor-thin margins. You know, I mean, I've never personally met especially family home childcare providers who are, you know, aren't necessarily just trying to make it by sustaining business. You know, unfortunately, too many of them have already closed during the pandemic because they had to make a difficult choice of saying, like, I can't afford to do this anymore. So, I mean, I think that should be the very first step, you know, ensuring that providers have what they need to keep their doors open. So when we're on the other side of this pandemic, and are in a safe place that kids come back, that they're ready to go. You know, I think it's investing in the childcare workforce. You know, this is a big piece. I mean, you know, I know you said it earlier. I mean, the people who are caring for our kids, you know, we should value and compensate them like they deserve to be compensated. And that means, you know, paying them livable and fair wages, making sure that we have training and educational opportunities for, you know, people to go into that field in each state and come out, you know, that this is a very valued professional workforce. You know, that's something, that's a long-term solution, but those are steps we could be taking now. And then also expanding eligibility for child care assistance. You know, looking at how can we, you know, grow scholarships, how can we make sure that families are getting the child care they need, you know, and expanding that eligibility. I know during the pandemic, we saw some expansion of this, particularly for essential workers, because we knew that child care was important for them to work. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean we need to go back to how it was. You know, we can look to keep investing in these programs to ensure that not just our essential workforce, but particularly low and middle income families can better afford childcare.
And, Ed, here in New Hampshire, we have something called the Child Care Scholarship Program, which supports working class folks with kids and child care, provides some assistance. Unfortunately, Governor Sununu has proposed cutting that by close to $15 million, and the House budget reflects that recommendation at this point. What is your recommendation or thoughts on those baseline assistance programs for working class folks? Obviously, the American Families Plan, as presented by President Biden, says no working class folk pay more than 7% of their income, but that hasn't passed. And right now we have largely a patchwork and framework of state assistance. How important is that kind of program? In New Hampshire, it's called the Child Care Scholarship Program, to maintain funding for that.
I think it's vital, especially right now when, you know, you're looking at, you have federal resources coming to each state to do exactly that. And not only that, but I mean, like, you know, the White House has given pretty specific guidance on how states can best utilize their dollars to make sure that they go the furthest and have the most impact for kids. And you know, funding a program or even expanding a program like that is exactly the steps that a state needs to take. And especially knowing that you have the resources right now to help state governments, you know, working up to ensuring that that can be done. You know, not just that, but even some of the local and state aid dollars. You know, I know that the last is encouraging them to invest in childcare assistance as well. I mean, again, because they recognize that, you know, economists recognize that childcare is so important to getting America back to full strength and its economy booming again, that they want lawmakers to prioritize childcare just like they would any other infrastructure or essential service right now in the country. So you know, we not only want to see a program like Childcare Scholarship Program, you know, adequately funded, we want to see it expanded. You know, we want to see it go further to help working families. Because the reality was, even before COVID, you know, these programs were only serving a small fraction of the folks who were eligible for them.
Right, right.
And we were advocating for more then, and should definitely be advocating for more now.
Because as you just mentioned, I mean, this industry has a tremendous impact on our economy. I don't think, you know, I'm sure many people realize it, especially those who utilize child care and daycare and all of those great services that are provided normally. But just touch on the impact it has, because as you said, the segment of our society that has been most impacted by this are working mothers who just cannot get back into the workforce because of the child care.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think there's been a big gender disparity in terms of, you know, how, particularly around the issue of child care. You know, I think some of the polling I've seen, you know, nationally has shown that, you know, the majority of parents with children at home have either, I think it was almost two-thirds, have either had to have, you know, left their job temporarily or change or even leave their job altogether because of lack of child care. And of course, you know, with COVID hitting, you know, and Dan, as I know you mentioned earlier, you know, we've all been impacted if you have young kids at home or even school-age kids because of school-related closures. They've had to leave our flexible jobs, but some have just not been able to get back to work just because of the line they worked in. It wasn't an opportunity to work from home, or, you know, they couldn't do that. So, you know, and let's be honest, I mean, there are just, you know, we know that child care and early child education is one of the ways, even beyond just getting parents back to work, to break cycles of poverty for kids. You know, kids who get a high-quality education are more likely to graduate from high school. You know, kids who attend preschool are more likely to have a higher income in life. You know, it's just such a good investment. You know, majority of the child's brain is developed before age 5. So, I mean, it just makes sense if we're going to make strategic investments that we're investing in the most formative years of a child's life to make sure they're getting education they need.
That's so true. And I have two daughters now that are both in their 30s. But they both went to daycare, child care, prior to kindergarten, and it had a tremendous impact on their lives. There's no doubt about that. I think, you know, what they learned and in fact, you know, just associating with, you know, different kids of, you know, all kinds of, you know, backgrounds and races, I think it makes a huge difference as they enter kindergarten, first grade, and so on. But I know that it had just a tremendously positive impact on my daughters, who now, as I said, both in their 30s. So, you know, it's just incredible what this means to the youngsters as well as their families.
Absolutely. You know, and I think another big piece of kindergarten readiness is preschool. You know, it's such an important year. I know, you know, part of the American Families Plan that was proposed is creating universal pre-K, but a lot of that is going to be led at the state and local level. And, you know, New Hampshire is one of only, you know, I think a few states left in the United States that does not invest in a state preschool program. So if you want to start to talk about opportunities, I mean, that's the low-hanging fruit, you know, of making sure that we can make smart investments in preschool in the near future. Because, I mean, there's no doubt about it that being a kid in New Hampshire, it's a great place. And it's always ranked, if you look at all the states in terms of, you know, child well-being, it's a great place to be a kid. But it's a really hard place to be a working parent because the state doesn't invest in child care, in public preschool, making sure it's available and accessible for parents. And that's going to have long-term consequences, I think, not just on parents, but on kids too.
It certainly had long-term consequences on competitiveness of the workforce as well. I mean, this key feature of attracting and retaining young people, young working families. Can you talk about that element? I know you touched on it a little bit in response to Ken's question, but you know, working families want this, they need this. This is part of how they, you know, decide where to live. Talk about the economic impact feature of it a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, no matter where we poll, if you talk to voters from all walks of life, doesn't matter what party they're in, you know, they support preschool, they support investments in early childhood education. It's overwhelming because the evidence is so strong and the economic ROI is so strong. It just makes sense. I mean, I think, you know, we work across the country at Save the Children Action Network. You know, we're led by a great team in New Hampshire, Emily Johnson and Lizzie Hansen. But, you know, even in other states that are traditionally conservative, so I know we work in Louisiana, Tennessee, South Carolina, you know, throughout the Southeast, for example, they have really strong preschool programs, and they're making investments right now, today, in child care because, you know, businesses are telling those governors and those lawmakers that they need these investments to support their workforce. And the Chamber of Commerce is telling, you know, lawmakers in those states, you know, this needs to be a priority. So, you know, this is really a bipartisan issue. You can be in the blue states in America or the reddest of the red states, and we're seeing really strong investments in this because of the economic argument and because it's the right thing to do for kids.
Yeah, no doubt about it, because it impacts the rest of their lives. There's no doubt about that. So it is very important that we not only maintain but expand our child care and preschool opportunities for youngsters in New Hampshire and everywhere. So it is such an important part, you know, of our, you know, development process for the youngsters in our lives. You know, Ed, before we let you go, I wanted to find out more about your time that you spent with you know, the National Park Service and the Centennial, the Find Your Voice. How was that program?
Oh, it was great. I mean, you know, I think it goes without saying that our national parks are amazing places to visit. You know, especially this summer, everyone needs to go find their park. You know, I always say I've been lucky to advocate for some of the most popular things in the country, the national parks, kids, you know, things everyone can agree that we should invest in. So, you know, you would think it would make my job easy, but let me tell you, we still have so much to do to make sure there's investments in all these things.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So if you get an opportunity this summer, check out a national park. There are a lot of them. And, you know, I tell you what, it's always a great family experience and a very inexpensive one, too. Once you get there.
Yeah.
Once you get there. Right,
right. Yeah.
That's true. Exactly. And, you know, I'm so happy. I think the Biden administration kept, you know, one of the programs developed in the Centennial, of every kid in a park program. And every fourth grader it gets a free national park pass, which if you've bought one before, I think it's like almost $100, and it gets you into all public lands for free. So if you have a fourth grader, that's your ticket too to get to the national park.
Wow!
But I would be remiss to say, I mean, we certainly hope you get involved with Save the Children Action Network this summer, because I know we still have a lot of advocacy work to do. So, you know, savethechildrenactionnetwork.org/NH, and we have a lot of opportunities coming up in New Hampshire too.
No doubt about that. Well, Ed, we appreciate you being with us on Feldes and Kale. Ed Sterley, Senior Director for state and national campaigns at Save the Children Action Network. And again, Ed, how you just mentioned it, but just to reiterate, how can people get more information?
Go to SaveTheChildrenActionNetwork.org/NH, and you'll get New Hampshire-specific information and see how you can advocate for kids today.
Outstanding. Ed, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
All right. That's Ed Sterley, the Senior Director for State and National Campaign, Save the Children Action Network. And, Dan, I can talk about it from years ago. My daughters both went to the We Play School in Manchester, and they did a fantastic job, and I know that they still are. And it is such an important piece of development for our youngsters. There's no question.
There's no question about it. And it's a big issue, obviously, right now. No, and I think it was an issue, as Ed mentioned, prior to COVID. But COVID really surfaced the challenges facing working families and child care, universal pre-K. As we talked about in the program, Ken, we've just made steps to do full-day kindergarten in New Hampshire. As Ed mentioned, we're one of only a few states that don't do any investment in pre-K. But we gotta get there and gotta support the youngsters, support working families. And as I mentioned, this budget that's floating through the state house, as proposed by Governor Sununu, cuts child care. House budget cuts child care. Hopefully the Senate restores those cuts to child care. We got to invest in child care, supporting our providers, supporting working families.
No, absolutely so. You know how many state parks there are in New Hampshire? I don't know this offhand.
I don't know it offhand either.
I just happened to Google it. That's all. Offhand, I would not have known it.
State parks are national.
Well, state parks, but we're talking about national parks here. But I'm just state parks regionally in New Hampshire. 93 state parks in the state
Holy
of New
mackerel.
Hampshire. Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot.
Not national parks, but state parks. And all, you know, very interesting and, you know, more than you know about. You can find very interesting things at all the state parks throughout the Granite State and throughout New England as well. We'll take a break, and then we'll return with another guest here on Feldis and Kale at 103.9, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back. Feldis and Kale at 103.9, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And joining us right now is Cindy Warmington. Cindy is the executive counselor for District 2 and currently the only Democrat on the 5-member executive council. Cindy has 40 years of healthcare experience, 20 as an attorney chairing the healthcare law practice at Shaheen and Gordon, and 20 years before that in hospital laboratory medicine and hospital business office management. And since taking office, Cindy has been a clear voice standing up for working families, public education, and health care, including mental health and reproductive rights. And Cindy Warmington, we welcome you to Feldis and Kale.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Well, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Counselor, for joining us. As the Executive Counselor for District 2, among other things, you take a look at judicial nominations, agency nominations, a key post, and do some oversight of state government. You've been a steadfast voice on the issues that Ken just mentioned, and one of the nominations recently in terms of judges was that of Pat Conway that you led on. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there and how that nomination was withdrawn?
So as soon as that nomination was announced by the governor, I started to receive phone calls from various constituents, people across the state expressing concerns about that nomination, many voicing concerns that Ms. Conway was very prosecutorial in her approach, and that they had concerns about her fairness and impartiality. Soon after that, the New Hampshire Bar Association released a letter indicating that they had found Ms. Conway to be qualified, but with reservations about her knowledge of the law outside of criminal law and also about her fairness and impartiality. And for those who are not a member of the bar, this is a really significant letter to be released by the New Hampshire Bar Association. I know that you know that, Senator Feltes, as a fellow member of the bar. This is a fairly unusual act for the bar to take action.
Right.
So that really, you know, brought this nomination, the level of concern of this nomination higher from my perspective. And I looked very carefully at this nomination, and in the course of doing a Google search of Ms. Conway, I found an article from 2014 indicating that she had not voted for 6 years before running for office in 2014. She was at that time running to be the Rockingham County Attorney, and someone, a newspaper reporter, asked her about not voting for 6 years. She didn't really answer the question about why she hadn't voted for 6 years, but she said, "But I did cast a ballot in Atkinson while I was helping my elderly father to the polls." And I just found that a curious statement, since, you know, you can't cast a ballot in a town that you don't live in. But I really didn't know any of the facts on the ground. I asked Ms. Conway a couple of questions about it at the hearing, and there was some follow-up from the press on that, and ultimately I know that information was uncovered that Ms. Conway had, in fact, it appeared that she had, in fact, voted in Atkinson at a time that she was living in Salem. I don't know the facts. I know that the tax records and the voting records were looked at by the press, that questions were then asked. I asked for an investigation by the Attorney General's office of that, and after that, Ms. Conway withdrew her nomination.
And that kind of work that Councilor Warmington did here is, you know, the work that counselors should do, and Councilor Warmington's doing a great job doing. And also, you did it on other nominations, including the key posts, not just judges, but key posts, agency posts. And one that went through, Dan Goldner, who I've met, nice guy, however, doesn't appear to be qualified at all for the Public Utilities Commission. Can you talk a little bit about that nomination and what went on there?
Yeah, this is one of the more frustrating nominations that we've had come forward in my mind, because as you know, Senator Feltes, in New Hampshire, the Public Utilities Commission is really a key agency for forwarding energy policy in this state. I know the governor has proposed a Department of Energy, but we don't have one, and a lot of this work is forwarded, the policy work in this state is forwarded through the work of the Public Utilities Commission. So this is really a critically important nomination. And when a nominee is scheduled for a hearing, I always schedule an interview, a time to talk to them in advance. I did that with Mr. Goldner, and this is not, for me, it's not a game of gotcha. I'm telling people what I'm interested in when I interview them. And specifically with Mr. Goldner, I told him, I asked him questions about energy efficiency, about distributed energy, about clean transportation technology, and about climate change. And I was really shockingly disappointed with his inability to answer my questions at the interview. I told him that I would be asking about these same areas a week later at his hearing. I did, and I basically got the same response. He doesn't know anything substantive about any of those topics. And those are really important issues. Moreover, he actually answered that he believes climate change has been going on for millions of years. He doesn't appear to recognize the threat that man-made activity is presented to the existence of our planet.
Well, and ultimately they ended up going through on a 4-1 vote, despite the concerns and the issues that you raised, but certainly playing that watchdog role. Not just in the context of nominations, you've been playing it in the context of oversight too, including on mental health, requesting and having the commissioner of HHS come in and actually present and talk about it. It was prior to the New Hampshire Supreme Court decision, landmark decision, requiring due process and not involuntarily holding people without a hearing beyond 3 days in our state, in hospitals, which we have an ER waiting list. We have a mental health crisis. The governor has failed to stand up services that were appropriated in the last budget. That's undisputed. Do you have any more updates from the department about what they're actually doing to stand up the services and programs that were appropriated in the last budget, fully funding the mental health plan?
I have been working with Senator Whitley and Senator Rosenwald and Senator Sherman. All of us have had a call last week with the commissioner. I know Senator Whitley and Senator Sherman and Senator Rosenwald have really been leaders on this in the Senate, and they, because of my interest in it, have invited me to also be a participant in those conversations. And I do think that this Supreme Court case has inspired the department to become even more dedicated and committed to resolving this issue once and for all. But it is one that has been left for years and years and years. And children in our state are sitting in hospital emergency rooms, not getting the treatment they need. And, you know, that I think the situation just exacerbates the crisis for the children, the families. And there are, of course, adults across our state that are entitled to these constitutional hearings. They're not getting them. They're not getting treated. It's an abominable situation. It needs to be addressed right away. And all I can say about what the department is doing is that we're continuing to dialogue with them, and that they are they have more concrete action steps than I have ever heard in the past. I am very hopeful that this decision will be the turning point in this crisis. And I just want to thank the ACLU for the work they did here.
No doubt about it. Bringing the case, all the hard work that they did on it. More oversight issues. Obviously the Department of Employment Security struggling with unemployment insurance, record claims, although warned at the beginning, just like at the beginning of COVID, just like during the Great Recession, that there could be mass overpayments and the computer system and different notices. They're acknowledging that quote-unquote rogue notices went out to thousands of people. There's thousands of people being hit with overpayments that, you know, were crushed by job loss during COVID and are struggling, and right now many of them still unemployed. Is there any effort right now, or thinking about any effort to kind of talk with the department, dialogue or hearing or anything, to really kind of see what they're doing to address this issue of this mass overpayments and these notices?
I have to say that is not an issue that constituents have been reaching out to me in fact, I don't think I've heard from a single constituent about that issue. I've heard it a little bit in the press, and I've talked to the commissioner about it, but I have not had any constituents reach out to me. And I think people should understand that executive counselors serve as your voices with state agencies if you're having problems. So everyone should feel free to call their executive counselor if they're having problems.
Yep.
And this is really how we have a pulse on what is going on in our community. So I understand in the press, and I've had conversations with the commissioner about this, but I'm not getting on the ground a real sense of the magnitude of this problem.
And how would, Counselor, how would people get in touch with you, for listeners who are out there who have an issue with state government? How would people get in touch with you? What's your contact information?
Yep, cindy.warmington@nh.gov. And it's on the state website. If you go to the executive council, all of the counselors are there. Their information with their contact information is on the website. So nh.gov, and then choose executive council, and the information is right there on the homepage. And it's an important part of the job. Everyone should realize that we really are here to speak for our constituents. And when people reach out, I reach out to the commissioners on their behalf. The commissioners are incredibly responsive to those requests by executive counselors. And so everyone across the state should know that and should feel free to reach out to their counselors.
Cindy, is this your first foray into politics?
It is. It is. I never imagined that I would be that I would run for elected office. I have long been an activist, both in the healthcare world and in the Democratic Party. I was the chair of my town Democratic Party for a long time, the secretary of my county party, and I was the platform committee chair for over a decade. But I never imagined that I would run. But when the opportunity presented itself and I was available to do it, I was happy to step up. And I have to tell you, the work is incredibly rewarding. It is fascinating to do the work. I know most people wouldn't find reading hundreds of contracts to be fascinating, but the devil's in the details, and I enjoy getting into the details. I love being out and about around the district, getting to hear people's stories, to hear what their concerns are, and to really advocate for them.
So obviously no regrets.
None. I'm loving it. I wish the only regret is that I'm in a 4-1 minority, and we hope to change that in the next election.
You know, the picture in my mind is the executive council chamber with those stacks and stacks of, as you said, contracts and all different kinds of, topics that are discussed and have to be decided by the executive council. You must be reading many hours every day.
It is a full-time job.
Yeah.
It truly is a full-time job. And for those who don't know, on every other Friday, the state police drive around the state and carry the contract to the executive council and deliver them to their homes. And I read all weekend, and then I speak to the commissioners on Monday and Tuesday. And on the off week, I'm researching nominations that the governor has brought forward and really focusing in on all those constituent services. So it's really a lot of work, and it's a lot of fun.
But it is very demanding. There's no doubt about that. As is, if you do it right, any job in the political world.
Exactly.
Right. Well, Cindy, it's great to have you with us here on Feldes and Kale. And, I know you've been in politics now only a short time, but I have a feeling that you're going to stay in the political world for a while.
Well, thank you. It is absolutely my pleasure to be here today.
All right. Great to have you with us, Cindy.
Thanks, Cindy.
Take care.
Thank you. Thank
Cindy
you, Dan.
Warmington, the executive counsel for District 2, currently, as she mentioned, the only Democrat on the 5-member executive council. We'll take a break. We're heading down the home stretch here on Feldes and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and our local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com, Feldes and Kale. Proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and our local New Hampshire dairy farmers. You know, we're talking about national parks and state parks in the opening segment. In New Hampshire, of course, we have the White Mountain National Forest, which most people are familiar with. And in Maine, they have two. They have Acadia and Baxter. I've never been to Baxter.
I've never been to Baxter either.
Have you been to Acadia?
I have.
Oh,
that's
wonderful. That is fantastic,
that's
isn't
wonderful.
It? What a place. And you know, a little known fact that I wasn't aware of until I actually visited Acadia is that they have a wonderful beach there as well. Have you seen the beach at Acadia?
I haven't been to the beach.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
Yep.
You always think, it's the first sunrise in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I've experienced that a couple of times. But Acadia, if you get a chance to go there, and it's about a 5-hour drive, let's say, give or take, from Concord. But it is a wonderful experience.
It certainly is. And, and then, as you mentioned, Ken, the White Mountain National Forest.
Yep.
Also an amazing experience.
It is. Oh, it definitely is.
And if you had to pick, stay in New Hampshire, right?
That's Dan Feldes. Yes. No, I'm only kidding. Yes, of course, stay in New Hampshire. Of course. And stay with WKXL, your home for Boston Celtics postseason basketball. Let's hope it lasts.
Let's hope.
More than a couple of games.
We'll see.
Yeah, we will. Thanks for listening. Feldes and Kale, 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com.